temple and paradise is adorned. In this month, the sustenance of the faithful is determined, and a month in which good deeds are reckoned manifold and righteous deeds yield 70-fold. The Noble Quran describes spring as a sign of God's power. In Ayah 9 of Surah Fatir, in the Holy Quran, we read, "It is Allah who sends the wind and they raise a cloud. Then we drive it toward a dead land, and with it revive the earth after its death. Likewise will be the resurrection." Also in Ayahs 5 and 6 of Surah Hajj in the Holy Quran, the Almighty says, "And you see the earth prop it, yet when we send down water upon it, it stirs and swells, and grows every delightful kind of plant. That is because Allah is reality, and it is He who revives the dead, and He has power over all things." Nowruz is the book of cognizance of God. This book is opened every year towards the men of learning and reflection. If we take a look with contemplation at blossoms and tree shoots, we will certainly be delighted and awakened. They teach us to refresh our mind and heart, to abandon evil thoughts and grudges, to love our fellow human beings, and be helpful and benevolent to others. The glorious Nowruz festivities are all meant as reminding us of our duties towards our brothers and sisters. Nowruz has preparations which start weeks and even months earlier. One of the main preparations or traditions is house cleaning and adornment of houses and streets as a welcome to spring. Cleanliness is indeed one of the affairs that has been highly recommended in Islam. The Prophet of Islam calls it one of the signs of faith. Moreover, in the last month of the year, the month of Isfand in the Iranian calendar, markets and shopping malls are full of people who come for buying new clothes. Wealthy people also try to refresh their furniture, their curtains and home appliances. People also buy nuts and fruits for Nowruz, the Iranian New Year. Of course, due to coronavirus epidemic, gatherings do not take place. Most people pay a visit to their elderly, especially parents and grandparents. Let us recite the prayer for the start of the new year. O developer of hearts and sights, O determiner of night and day, O turner of state and conditions, turn our state to the best of states.
In the limelight. Studies show climate change is supercharging some weather and climate events and will lead to more severe and longer-lasting heat waves, stronger hurricanes, an increased wildfire risk, and a longer wildfire season, says Tara Lohan, writer, in an article published under the heading, Climate-driven extreme weather is imperiling wildlife conservation efforts. Here's more. Hailstorm in South Texas, tornadoes in Tennessee, wildfires across the West, a barrage of hurricanes. Those are among the record 22 weather and climate disasters that each topped $1 billion in damages last year in the United States. In all, the price tag for 2020 hit a whopping $95 billion, and that's just in the United States. Reinsurance firm Swiss Re put global economic losses at $175 billion last year, including $32 billion for floods in China and $13 billion in damages from Cyclone Amphan across India and Bangladesh. Studies show that climate change is supercharging some weather and climate events and will lead to more severe and longer-lasting heat waves, stronger hurricanes, an increased wildfire risk, and a longer wildlife season. We can also expect more heavy rain events and severe droughts, not to mention other extreme events like February's polar vortex. You can't attribute any particular storm to climate change, but what we can do know is that climate change tips the odds of making many of these events more severe, says Bruce Stein, chief scientist and associate vice president at the National Wildlife Federation. While experts tabulate the economic losses, including homes destroyed, crops ruined, businesses shuttered, ecosystems and wildlife can also sustain damage that's harder to quantify. Many plants and wildlife evolved with and have adapted to dealing with large-scale disturbances, but we are beginning to see mega disturbances at levels beyond what we saw in the past, says Stein, and that can take a toll. Extreme weather can kill animals directly or indirectly, like by destroying food sources, contaminating water, or altering habitat, forcing a species to move into areas where there may be more competition, fewer resources, or a greater risk of predation. What we begin to find when you get some of these mega disturbances is that it's beyond the ability of a species or their adaptive capacity to bounce back, says Stein. The effects of climate change on the natural world are being felt at two speeds. One is more gradual, referred to by scientists as ramping, shrinking glaciers, rising sea levels. The second is quick, like extreme weather events. Both are problematic, says Sean Maxwell, a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Queensland Centre for Biodiversity and Conservation Science. But he adds, I think the changes to acute events have the greatest potential to devastate local populations or ecosystems, and the impacts of these events are often more difficult to plan or to avoid. Maxwell was the lead author of a 2018 study published in the journal Diversity and Distributions that examined how changes in the frequency and intensity of extreme weather and climate events affected wildlife. The researchers looked at 519 studies of ecological responses to extreme events, including cyclones, droughts, floods, and heat and cold waves that took place from 1941 to 2015. They found that the response was negative 57% of the time. Some of the negative responses we found were quite concerning, including more than 100 cases of dramatic population declines and 31 cases of local population extinction following an extreme event, says Maxwell. Populations of critically endangered bird species in Hawaii, such as the palea, have been annihilated due to drought, and populations of lizard species have been wiped out due to cyclones in Bahamas. Plant species, the researchers found, had the highest number of negative responses to extreme events, followed by reptiles and amphibians. Collectively, the studies in our review suggest that extreme weather and climate events have profound implications for species and ecosystem management, the researchers concluded. Species that are already threatened or endangered are, of course, especially at risk. Take the Atwater prairie chicken. A million of these birds once ranged across the prairie of Texas and Louisiana. Today, fewer than 100 remain in the wild, and scientists have sought to bolster their populations with captive breeding programs. But when Hurricane Harvey walloped Texas with 130 mph winds and record rainfall in 2017, the birds were right in harm's way. The Atwater Prairie Chicken National Wildlife Refuge tracked 29 individual birds, mostly hens. Post-hurricane staff confirmed only 5 of them still alive, Texas Climate News reported. It added, the hurricane also killed roughly 80% of a prairie chicken population on private property in Goliad County. Other species with limited ranges, like those on islands, also face big threats. If a species is well distributed, then if one part of its range gets hit, there is the ability for it to recover, says Stein. But if essentially all its eggs are on one basket, and that particular place gets hit by one of these big disturbances, that's when you have a real concern. In 2017, Hurricane Maria cut the population of just 200 Puerto Rican parrots in half. The year before, Hurricane Matthew was believed to have wiped out Las Bahama nuthatches, that is Sitta insurils. It took 2 years before a few of the birds were found, and then Hurricane Dorian struck in 2019, making their survival unlikely, according to Diana Bell, a professor of conservation biology at the University of East Anglia. In fact, Dorian may have not only sealed the fate of the nuthatch, but also severely impacted other birds endemic to these islands, particularly the Bahama warbler and abaco parrot, Bell wrote in an essay for the conservation. Also known as the Bahama Amazon parrot, this subspecies uniquely nests in limestone cavities underground, which are likely to have been flooded by the storm surge. The risk to wildlife from extreme storms can be compounded by the ramping effects of climate change, too. If you have increasingly severe hurricanes where you'd also got sea level rise essentially providing a higher latch point for the storm surge, then you start seeing impacts beyond the historical record, says Stein. In other places, extreme weather is an extra blow to species already struggling with other environmental pressures like habitat loss, invasive species, or pollution. Last year, the world watched in horror as land use management, climate change, and drought helped push Australia's bushfires to a terrifying new level, killing 34 people and burning 37,500 square miles. In the immediate aftermath, one expert put the death toll for wildlife at 1 billion animals less. Since then, the figure has been revised to 3 billion killed or displaced by the blazes. A study published in Nature Ecology and Evolution found that the fire impacted the critical habitats of 832 native species, with 70 species losing more than 30% of their natural range. 21 of those were already at risk of extinction. Those that survive could find themselves hard-pressed in future climate disasters. Multiple extreme events are likely to act in synergistic ways to exacerbate risk of species extinction, wrote Maxwell and the other researchers of 2018 study. Australia already has one of the highest extinction rates, and the wildfires could limit the capacity of some species to recover, like the endangered kangaroo island Donard and the long-footed Puturo, and threaten others. Australia's record blazes last year could push the number of endangered species in the country up by 19%, the study in Nature Ecology and Evolution found. When Hurricane Irma sacked the Florida Keys in 2017, the storm tossed boats ashore, destroyed more than 1,000 homes, and left a trail of debris across the islands. It also endangered one of the region's beloved endemic species, the tiny key deer, which today primarily live on Big Pine Key. Some deer were killed in the storm, and surviving animals faced threats to their already limited freshwater supply as the storm surge dumped saline ocean water into freshwater pools. Island residents responded the way folks often do after a disaster. They offered help to their neighbors. What you saw during and shortly after Irma is that these key deer were coming up to houses looking for fresh water, says Stain, and people were putting out kiddie pools of water for them. But beyond immediate food and water relief, there is a much bigger task ahead. Reducing greenhouse gas emissions to address the ongoing dangers of climate change and the ability of ecosystems to adapt. Key deer, for example, also face a long-term threat to their drinking water supply from rising seas. Sometimes no number of kiddie pools can repair. And more severe hurricanes are likely in their future too. As climate change continues to ensure extreme climate and weather events are more and more common, we now need to act to ensure species have the best chance to survive, says Maxwell. Wherever possible, high-quality and intact habitat areas should be retained, as these are the places where species are most resilient to increasing exposure to extreme events. If such intact habitat doesn't exist, ecological restoration efforts can be used to help species adapt, his study found.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
around the world with reporters.
Belgium's largest COVID-19 vaccination centre, located in Hazel on the outskirts of Brussels City. Like hundreds of similar venues across the EU, officials here are worried about vaccine supply. 33-year-old nurse Alex Gavoni has arrived to get the jab.
I have a vaccination centre behind my house, but I could not go there because they don't have enough supplies. And this place is a bit far away from me, for the other people that have to come. And as a nurse, I'm a bit concerned that the people will not take the vaccine because of the confusion with AstraZeneca for the moment.
AstraZeneca is contracted to supply the EU with 90 million doses before the end of this month, but will only deliver 30 million. The firm is supposed to supply 180 million doses in April, May and June, but says it will only provide 70 million.
AstraZeneca has underproduced and underdelivered.
Key EU member states will start to administer AstraZeneca again after being reassured by health authorities amid safety concerns.
This is a safe and effective vaccine.
Experts are asking, due to the EU's dismal handling of the affair, how many people will be willing to take the jab. In any case, the German government says there are not enough vaccines in the EU to prevent a third wave. For example, infection rates are again out of control in France and Italy. Health officials say the UK variant of the virus is wreaking havoc in Poland. Many hospitals are reaching breaking point.
Health experts warn that when centres are not being fully utilised, COVID-19 mutations are allowed to develop in the community. The big concern is future variants might be even more contagious and more deadly. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon is fighting for her political life. An inquiry into her handling of the sexual harassment charges brought against her predecessor Alex Salmond is underway. Salmond and Sturgeon have both given evidence, but a leaked draft report has revealed committee members have voted 5-4 that Sturgeon gave them an inaccurate account of what happened. However, she says she stands by every word.
I think the first thing to say is I stand by all of the evidence I gave to the committee, all 8 hours worth of evidence. I mean, what's been clear is that opposition members of this committee made their minds up about me before I uttered a single word of evidence. Their public comments have made that clear. So this leak from the committee, very partisan leak tonight, before they've actually finalised the report, is not that surprising. So let's wait and see the final report. But more importantly, the question of whether or not I breached the ministerial code is being considered independently by James Hamilton QC, and I hope and expect to receive and publish that report soon.
If that inquiry also finds against her, she is not legally compelled to resign, but she'll be under a lot of pressure to do so. A recent poll shows her party have a 22-point lead, so she may well remain First Minister after the May elections. What's certain is Sturgeon isn't going down without a fight. In the evidence she gave earlier this month, she defended her position, accused Salmond of inappropriate behaviour, and apologised directly to the two women that were let down by the government investigation.
A number of women made serious complaints about Alex Salmond's behaviour. The government, despite the mistake it undoubtedly made, tried to do the right thing. As First Minister, I refused to follow the age-old pattern of allowing a powerful man to use his status and connections to get what he wants.
Alex Salmond was cleared of all charges and compensated for his legal fees, but now Sturgeon is on the ropes. Many are questioning why a new policy on sexual harassment, inspired by the Me Too movement, could be used to bring down the First Minister, a woman herself and one of the most successful politicians of a generation. Analysts say one reason might be that she is also the figurehead of Scotland's independence campaigners. Bianca Rahimi, London.
representatives of the Afghan government, influential political leaders, the Taliban and some key regional and international players have decided to continue negotiations on the fate of the Afghan peace trend in Moscow. There are two main scenarios on the negotiating table at the Moscow summit in order to bring peace to war-ravaged Afghanistan.
The first scenario for the transition of power from President Ashraf Ghani is to establish a transitional government. This scenario has so far been backed by some players, including Russia, the US, Pakistan, and China.
However, experts here believe the second scenario that will most probably gain support from Iran and India follows another solution, which is holding an early election for the transition of power. This comes while war-weary Afghans say, as their country has entered a very different phase of its history, it's too important for influential political leaders to make a united front and convince all players to just put an end to war at any cost.
Our country is bleeding and it needs help from all those who are involved in the Afghanistan crisis. But we want our own leaders to set aside their differences and lead the country to lasting peace.
Locals here also call on the Taliban to respect people's demand and honestly work on a true peace plan if they are not serving foreign players.
The Taliban needs to realize that there are no military solutions to the crisis, so it should say no to foreign demands that are against Afghanistan's national interests and closely work with others to bring calm and stability to Afghanistan.
Let's not forget that the Afghan government had already rejected Russia's agenda regarding the Afghan peace process, and now another summit is slated to be held in Turkey in 2 weeks. The Turkey conference will also work on the Afghan peace process, but only time will tell whether those meetings can lead the country to peace and stability. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Helpless parents in this protest held in Pakistan's capital Islamabad. They have a tragic story which they say no one is willing to listen in Pakistan. Their two sons, one after the other, disappeared. One of them disappeared 7 years ago, while the another one just last week. They have no clue about the whereabouts of their sons.
If my sons are found guilty, the government must punish them. But if not, then must set them free. But no one in the government listens to us. We don't know what to do.
This is just tip of the iceberg of the tragedy of the victims of thousands of similar cases of enforced disappearances. It all started in late 2001 when the US-led NATO forces invaded neighboring Afghanistan and Islamabad joined their so-called war on terror. Pakistan's secret services have been at the heart of allegations to have illegally detained citizens under the cover of so-called war on terror. A significant number among the detained citizens were allegedly secretly handed over to the US. The repeated demands of the victim families to either prosecute their loved ones or set them free have gone unheard in Pakistan. Despite promises to set them free, the successive civilian governments and judiciary have done little to help the victim families. The country's military-run secret services have mostly defied the orders of Pakistan's superior courts to release the missing citizens, languishing in jail for years, some of them well over a decade without any charge sheet.
There's no power with the politicians. There's no power with the in the democracy in Pakistan. They cannot ask them. There's no accountability of the intelligence agencies for doing illegal activities. They are out of the ambit of law. They can do anything. Any army person, any uniformed person can just blame anybody and that person will be disappeared. That person will be in jail.
In a controversial move, Pakistan's parliament provided blanket immunity to the secret services in 2014 from prosecution on the charges of illegal detention, torture, and killing of citizens. Nonetheless, this did not bring any significant let-up in enforced disappearances in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
An amnesty bill for Catalonia's jailed leaders was put before Spain's Congress of Deputies on Tuesday to end the political crisis in the northeastern region. The bill was filed by lawmakers from the four Catalan pro-independence parties with the support of Òmnium Cultural, a grassroots organization whose leader was found guilty of sedition in the 2017 referendum trial and sentenced to 9 years in jail.
We brought forward the amnesty law as a starting point for a democratic solution. If the government really believes that the repression exerted in Catalonia was a mistake, it should adopt the amnesty law as a way to correct that mistake.
Spain's ruling Socialist Party had dismissed the amnesty bill even before it reached Congress.
We have always expressed opposition against amnesty. We're always willing to accept particular cases and in accordance with the legal framework. But we have never opted for such an amnesty that undoubtedly has much more political character of acquittal.
The socialists say they favor other solutions to amnesty, namely a presidential pardon or a reform of the sedition law that sentenced the jailed Catalan leaders to up to 13 years behind bars. For the separatists, neither of these proposals addresses the hundreds of independence-related legal cases they claim are pending trial in Spain's courts.
With the amnesty bill doomed to fail from the outset, the fate of jailed leaders now goes down the path of either clemency or the reform of Spain's criminal code. A slow and winding path that even the most optimistic in Catalonia say it will lead nowhere. Cusay Kedri, Barcelona.
The second Tehran Dialogue Forum was held virtually, but the messages were as strong as last year's. Foreign ministers of Iran, Turkey, and Afghanistan discussed the latest major issues in the Middle East, from terrorism to the U.S. destabilizing presence in the region. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made the opening speech, where he touched on the U.S. intervention in the region, saying Washington has spent billions of dollars on its military sector only to perpetuate insecurity in the region.
The U.S. has exacerbated the insecurity and instability of this region more than any other region. As its own figures suggest, some $7 trillion have been wasted on forever wars and military interventions in this region.
Zarif also censured the U.S. for keeping its anti-Iran sanctions amid the pandemic, calling the measures an economic war waged against the Iranian people.
U.S. coercive economic measures directed against the Iranian people, especially at a time of pandemic, are nothing less than economic warfare. And as we now witness, there has been yet no difference in following a failed policy of the so-called maximum pressure between the former and the current U.S. presidents.
Echoing Zarif's remarks, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu also rejected the unilateral U.S. sanctions against Iran, saying Ankara supports a U.S. return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and its full implementation.
From the very beginning, we have stood alongside Iran against unilateral sanctions. And Turkey has always supported the full implementation of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Now we support the new U.S. administration's declared intention to return to the deal. And we are hopeful that a mutually acceptable formula will be found to revive the JCPOA.
Afghan Foreign Minister Hanif Atmar was another diplomat at the virtual meeting who said his country should not become a safe haven for terrorists.
It's important for the region and for the outside world to realize the fact that outside problems should not be fought over on Afghan soil.
Tehran Dialogue Forum held its first edition last year with the presence of senior officials and heads of research institutes from different countries. The aim is to discuss views on major developments in sensitive areas, including the Persian Gulf and West Asia.
It seems that the trilateral meeting boils down to a single message.
Three major countries in the region, Iran, Turkey and Afghanistan, believe that it's time for the U.S. to stop its problematic behavior in West Asia. They say it can start by leaving the region and its people alone. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
As its own figures suggest, some $7 trillion have been wasted on forever wars and military interventions in this region.
The top Iranian diplomat underlined that the U.S. interventions are aimed at dominating the region. He said the region has turned into a military zone for the U.S. and its allies through their troop presence and arms sales to certain states. Addressing the Tehran Dialogue Forum, Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad highlighted the U.S. occupation of his country. He said that Washington formed a coalition under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but its main agenda was to attack Syria and threaten other regional countries.
The United States and the European Union, or the leading countries in the European Union, are using this coalition to attack Syria, to threaten other independent countries in the region, and to claim that they are fighting against Daesh. Daesh, in fact, has been encouraged and supported by the United States.
Years of devastation in Syria caused by the U.S. and its allies with the backing to terror groups are just the tip of the iceberg. U.S. interventionist agenda in other countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen and Libya all show that Washington wants to destabilize West Asia to dominate it. However, such stance has simply ignited anti-U.S. sentiment across many countries. In Iraq, protests against the presence of American troops and a parliamentary resolution for the expulsion of all U.S. troops last year are part of the sentiment. Calls grew louder after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes in a drone attack in January last year. The U.S. too has come to a conclusion that its West Asia policies have been a complete failure. Last week, the U.S. government, for the first time, acknowledged that the Yemen war has no military solution. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also told UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, that diplomatic efforts should be redoubled with the help of the UN and other players to end the Yemen war. But shouldn't Washington be blamed for the Yemen carnage, as it's been the main supplier of arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies that invaded the impoverished nation? But the U.S. views the West Asia region as a military zone, and what matters to Washington most is making profit out of chaos and conflicts, for it can sell more weapons to the rich Arab states.
Nowruz is the most widely celebrated holiday in the Islamic Republic of Iran. It means new day that marks the first day of spring. The holiday, which usually falls on or around March 21st, is widely celebrated across the West and Central Asia. Iran's foreign ministry invited the envoys of the Nowruz region to mark the event. Held in the presence of ambassadors, Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif congratulated the arrival of spring.
On Darsinas.
The lesson that all must learn is that there is only a superpower in the world, and that is the Almighty God. There is no other superpower in the world. Those who were boasting of their military, economic and scientific power all were defeated by a tiny virus.
Iran's Minister of Cultural Heritage, Tourism and Handicrafts, Ali Asghar Mounesan, and Minister of Science, Research and Technology, Mansour Ghulami, also attended the ceremony and made a short speech. Mexico's ambassador to Tehran said, Nowruz is very similar to traditions in Mexico.
La verdad es que estoy muy, muy conmovido.
Nowruz is very interesting to me. Few people in Mexico know about this celebration. I see a very happy atmosphere in Tehran, especially since you are apparently entering the new century. Another thing that caught my attention is the human relations that take place during the Nowruz celebrations, which is very similar to the celebrations in Mexico. For example, the whole family goes shopping for New Year here, and it is the same way in Mexico.
Some traditional musical bands from across Iran performed some pieces for the visitors. A half-seen sofra was also set in the iconic Mashq Square to mark the festivity of Nowruz. The message of Nowruz, which is revival and a new life, was also projected on a historic building inside the ministry complex via video mapping.
Over 300 million people celebrate Nowruz across the globe. In Iran, it is the most important holiday that marks the beginning of the new year. Nowruz has been celebrated in Iran for over 3,000 years. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
The debate over the policing of a London vigil on March 13th for Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old woman allegedly kidnapped and murdered by a serving British police officer earlier this month, is ongoing. What had been a peaceful and respectful demonstration of female solidarity turned ugly. Police moved in, pushing and shoving the demonstrators, and took away some of the women in handcuffs.
I've never been in a situation like this before, so I just thought, well, if I just don't say anything, I'm not sure what to do. But, you know, I just stood there, and I know a police officer was pulling my arm, trying to get my name, and then all of a sudden, I was tackled to the ground.
The sight of women who had come to stand together against male violence being manhandled led to a chorus of criticism from across the political spectrum. Attention soon shifted to this woman, Metropolitan Police Commissioner Cressida Dick, forced to explain her officer's actions to the authorities and to defend herself.
I don't think anybody who was not in the operation can actually pass a detailed comment on the rightness and wrongness of it.
She has so far rejected calls for her resignation from those she described as armchair critics, who believe police handling of the vigil was heavy-handed. But she has the backing of the government. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he has full confidence in her. In fact, the force she leads may be getting the powers she asked for after the Extinction Rebellion protests of 2019, a new law and order bill. Critics, among them conservative MPs, have called it a mess and an attack on people's right to protest.
300 or so pages, 170-something clauses, and almost nothing, if you can believe it, on violence against women and girls. The gaping hole in this bill is why we'll be voting against it.
The main focus of the criticism of the bill is its wording. For example, it gives the police the power to impose conditions on processions and public assemblies if the noise generated by the persons taking part may result in serious disruption to the activities of an organization which are carried out in the vicinity.
I'm really worried about it. It gives the police a lot of powers to decide what they think is an unacceptable protest, powers that can be decided later in law. It's not very clear. Just their conception of what might be a public annoyance or nuisance is potentially going to be a reason to shut down a protest and for prison sentences of up to 10 years. That's a bit of an assault on democracy.
Just imagine going to jail for making noise or causing inconvenience. The British government will have some tough questions to answer from MPs on its new policing bill, such as how it defines such unspecified terms as noise or serious inconvenience, and how giving sweeping, ill-defined powers to the police will affect freedom of expression in this country. Saeed Pourreza, London.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haidar. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So today we have a very interesting and intricate topic to be discussing, inshallah. To open up the discussion, I'd like to ask Sayyid Shahriar to shed some light on the JCPOA. And, you know, this is, the world does view it as between USA and Iran. Whose fault was it for leaving? I mean, I have a feeling which way this conversation is going to go, which direction it's going to take.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Yeah, just a little bit of a background on this JCPOA.
So this is a agreement that was done by multiple countries. It was not just the United States. So the countries involved, they're also called the P5+1, mm-hmm. right? So you have the United States, Britain, France, Russia, China. This is the P5. And then plus one is Germany. And, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran. So this is a nuclear deal that took a couple of years to come to fruition. It was quite difficult. But all of the parties, they signed this JCPOA, which pretty much the crux of the matter was that sanctions will be lifted from the Islamic Republic of Iran in exchange for certain limitations upon their nuclear program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is the background. Of course, very quickly, so this JCPOA occurred during the Obama administration, which includes the current president, who was then vice president, Joseph Biden. These guys, they made the deal, right? And then when Donald Trump came in as the next president, he called it a lousy deal, and he left the deal, right, unilaterally, without the consent of any of the other partners, and which, of course, is, you know, the United Kingdom and France and Germany and Russia and China. So this kind of shows you this kind of very one-sided mentality of the United States of America. Go it alone. We don't care about anybody else, even if you are our own friends. So, yes, United States of America was the country that decided to one-sided, unilaterally leave the JCPOA.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, Sheikh Ali, what do you have to say about it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, as Sayyid beautifully summarized here, JCPOA is an agreement between the world's so-called superpowers and the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is definitely a regional power, to say the least, and inshallah on its way to becoming that superpower and have a very serious role in the entire world dynamics. So the idea was because of the fame and popularity of the Islamic Republic of Iran and its notions, its human-based principles, which they were and have been standing on, they tried to contain the Islamic Republic and its development and its progress. And what did they use to contain the Islamic Republic? It was this deal. It's called JCPOA, which is also known as Barjam in Farsi. And, you know, the purpose of this deal was to really contain the progress and development of the Islamic Republic of Iran when it comes to its nuclear enrichment program. Now, for our listeners, you know, one thing has to be very clear, that there are two things that need to be understood. One is nuclear enrichment, which is the right of every nation, and the other is nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the right of none,
and
because of its collateral damage.
Right, and nuclear enrichment is the same as nuclear energy?
It's the nuclear energy, right?
Okay.
So you enrich uranium to get to a certain level where it converts into energy, which can be then used for the betterment of the society and the development of nations and countries. Now, this is a right of every nation to enrich uranium so they can fulfill their needs when it comes to energy.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to nuclear weapons, it's an entirely different ballgame. You enrich uranium to a point where you turn it into weapons, and these are the weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And who has it? Only a select few countries in the world have it.
Mm-hmm.
And who has used it? It's only the United States of America who
only
has used
it. Only one country that's used it.
Right? Mm. So this weapon program is an issue which, according to Islam, as the leader of the Islamic Republic and the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said, it is haram, it is forbidden to attain and to make and to possess and to use these weapons, Islamically speaking. So the Islamic Republic of Iran was never, is not, and will not be pursuing the nuclear weapons,
right,
which the West has it, right? Israel has it, right? Without signing the NPT even, right? Islamic Republic, in principle, is against this whole acquisition of these weapons because of the nature of these weapons and how they cause the collateral damage. And it, you know, you remember Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm.
So Islamic Republic is against acquiring those weapons, but Islamic Republic is adamant and is insistent, and rightly so, for the acquisition of nuclear energy,
right,
which is a right of every nation. So they want to contain Iran, contain its progress, contain its development, and hence they came up with this so-called deal, which is the JCPOA, so that nuclear program stops. And why do they not want Iran to acquire it? Just very quickly, last point.
Acquire nuclear energy.
Energy. Mm. Because they don't want to see an Islamic Iran which is independent.
Mm.
They want dependency. The West wants dependency. And they want Iran to be subjugated to the West and look towards the West when it comes to fulfilling their own needs.
Yeah, if it's self-sufficient, then it no longer has any need for the West.
Exactly.
So,
It's very interesting, this point that Sheikh Ali brought up about nuclear energy, right? So in one of the recent speeches from the month of February, I think, towards the end of February, the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, he has a very interesting point where he brings this up. So he says that at the current time, the West is buying barrel after barrel of oil at an incredibly cheap price. I mean, they're pretty much bottled water is more expensive than the oil that is being sold to Western countries in today's time. Okay? And oil, I believe it was Henry Kissinger, he said that if you control the oil, you control the governments.
Mm-hmm.
So they're controlling the governments based upon Henry Kissinger's. He was Secretary of State in one of the United States government, famous guy.
One of the think tanks.
Yeah, one of those very famous. And so he said if you control the oil, you control the governments. And so now we find that they are not only controlling the oil, but the governments at a very, very cheap price. So after this, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, right, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, he says that, but if these countries, for example, France or Germany or the United States or the UK, if they were oil producers, they wouldn't even sell us this same oil bottle by bottle, right? So he's saying we're selling it to these guys barrel by barrel. And if it was them, the ones who were producing oil, they wouldn't even sell it to us bottle by bottle.
And they do it, right? Look at the technology, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are certain bans on technologies that, for instance, Iranians are not allowed to pursue.
Yeah.
Right? They do it.
Yeah.
This is the nature of the West. But yeah, it's a...
Yeah, bottle by bottle, right? And so then after that, he says, and this is the vision of this leader, a vision that you do not see in any other so-called Muslim governments or Muslim leaders in other parts of the Muslim world. He very clearly says, and this is from last month, February's speech, he says that nuclear energy is the future.
Mm-hmm.
And they do not want us to be able to have our own nuclear energy, right? And he says, why? It's just like the oil. So what they want to do is to be able to control nuclear energy and then in the future, you know, charge us an arm and a leg for this very same nuclear energy that, as Sheikh Ali said, it should be free for all. It is the right for all nations. So a very interesting thing on nuclear energy.
There's really the dependence on the West, right? They don't want to see any nation to be independent, let alone the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is standing on human principles, right?
Right.
They don't want to see an Islamic Iran which is independent, and that's what it boils down to.
Inshallah, let's continue with this thought on dependency, because they want us to be economically dependent on America and the West. They want us to be dependent in other ways too, right?
Yeah, technologically dependent in terms of our food needs, in terms of the energy need, in terms of our well-being, you know, let it be vaccines right now.
Mm-hmm.
They're pushing hard for us to just go and get their vaccines, what they are developing, no matter how flawed those vaccines are, no matter how untested those vaccines are. Why are they pushing for it?
Yeah.
Well, they're pushing simply not because they want to help any nation, let alone the nation of the Islamic Republic of Iran. They are pushing so the other nations are dependent on them. And this is one thing that Islam has taught us, right? Islam, even at a very individual level, at a very singleton level, Islam has pushed for independency, right? Islam doesn't want to see beggars on the street asking other people for their livelihood. Islam doesn't want to see these small little setups to be dependent on the bigger setups, right? Islam doesn't want to see these small countries, the third world countries, to be dependent on the so-called superpowers, right? Islam has taught us the lesson of integrity, dignity, independence, right? Self-sufficiency, depending on your own abilities, depending on your own resources, depending on your own people. You know, this is a message for the governments of the world, especially the governments of the third world countries, that you are expected and supposed to be independent. You have to be depending on your own strengths and your own people. And this is the message of the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. One of the things that I see with Iran is, and it's really fascinating, how they believe in empowering other nations. See, when West comes to help any nation, their model is to make them dependent, more dependent and more dependent, yes, right? Yes, yes. So they're like, you know, completely controlled, manipulated, and their resources are looted and used. But when it comes to the Islamic Republic helping other nations, it is beautiful, right? They try to empower that nation.
Yeah.
You have seen it in case of Syria. You have seen it in case of Iraq. You have seen it in case of Yemen. You are seeing it as a matter of fact, right? Palestine, for instance, right? It's not that Iran sent like all of these military men and, you know, fighter jets and everything to Palestine. No, they said, you are going to determine your own fate. Right, you have to stand tall on your feet against the oppressors and aggressors. And yes, we will help if you want to stand up. Right, this is empowerment. Right, this is way different than you know, looking at another nation as if, oh, now they're stuck, so let's just abuse them, misuse them, and, you know, control them.
You know, it's funny that you. It's really interesting, actually, that you mentioned dependency even when it comes to food, because America, one of their plans is to control world food, isn't it? Through these big corporations. There's actually a hadith that I heard just yesterday from Imam Sadiq. He said that one who worries about his sustenance has actually sinned. It's a form of sinning to worry about your sustenance of today or tomorrow, right? And it just goes to show you that Islam really does want people to be independent, because it's through fear that they actually control people. It's through fear that you won't be able to provide for yourself, fear that you won't be able to produce your own energy, your own food. I don't know if you've heard, Sayed, about Henry Kissinger's 1974 plan.
No, go ahead.
There was a classified 200-page study in which the study falsely claimed that population growth in so-called lesser developed countries was a grave threat to U.S. national security.
Right.
So since then, they've been plotting to actually stop the growth, the population growth in other countries, and food has a major role to play with it.
Yeah, I don't know if you, I don't think we have too much time on the program, but if our listeners, they do a little bit of research on, for example, companies such as Monsanto and genetically modified seeds that can only be bought by companies, and there are seeds that do not reproduce other plants, a very interesting thing to research. But one thing that I think is important is this cultural dependency as well, that the West is trying to create all over the world, where it is their culture that needs to be implemented across the globe, whether it's their music or it's their ethics, their morality, their philosophies, their everything. Also a very dangerous thing, cultural dependency upon the West.
Yeah. They wish for other countries, especially Iran, to be dependent on them in various different ways. Nuclear energy is one of them. Food is one of them. Just very quickly, America actually adopted as official policy in November 1975 by President Gerald Ford this food control, this population control. It outlined a covert plan to reduce population growth in those countries through birth control and also implicitly war and famine. That's all we have time for today. Inshallah, next time we're going to be talking about the JCPOA more and delving deeper into the psyche behind this whole phenomenon. From myself, from Sayed Mehdi, and from Sheikh Ali, we bid you assalamu alaikum.